Chronicles Revisited Podcast, Episode 8, An Apple II in Every Dugout, Steve Boros and the Early Days of Computers in Baseball. Welcome to the Chronicles Revisited Podcast. I'm S.M. Oliva. I write the blog Computer Chronicles Revisited, which reviews the people and products featured on the PBS series that aired between 1983 and 2002. In this podcast, I focus on individual stories that I've previously featured on the blog. In this episode, I'm looking at Steve Boros, a two-time Major League Baseball manager who appeared on a 1985 Computer Chronicles episode to discuss his use of computers during his tenure with the Oakland Athletics. The A's, of course, are famously identified with Moneyball, the 2003 book by Michael Lewis that was later adapted into a film and described how the team's general manager, Billy Beane, made use of advanced statistical analysis to build a winning club in one of the major league's smallest markets. But 15 years before Beane's tenure as GM began, there was Steve Boros. Now, as we'll see, Boros' role in baseball's computer revolution was exaggerated in the media. Even his Computer Chronicles appearance lent him a technological credibility that was more puffery than reality. Not that Boros was a fraud or a huckster. Rather, he was a well-liked and well-respected baseball lifer who adapted to a new technology that was actually being pushed by others in the Oakland A's organization. Boros' time on Computer Chronicles was part of a broader look at computers and sports that first aired in March 1985. Boros was not managing at the time. He was working for the San Diego Padres as their minor league instruction coordinator. Boros appeared on a panel with Billy Hicks, a customer support manager from MDS Quantel, which produced one of the first computer systems dedicated to statistical analysis in sports, primarily by the National Football League. Speaking with Stuart Chaffee and Gary Kildall, Boros explained how he automated his own use of statistical analysis during his tenure in Oakland.
Steve, I understand that in the past you've gathered statistics about games to help you with your strategies and so forth, done this manually, and then you've gone on and automated some of these processes. What do you do? How do you use these numbers, and what do you do?
Well, initially, with the A's, what we try to do is keep track of the matchups, our hitters versus the opposing pitchers and vice versa. The classic example I use is Situation Detroit, when I was thinking about pushing Dwayne Murphy down the lineup. He's our team captain and hitting fourth and struggling. And I noticed, according to the matchups, that he was something like 8-for-16 against Dan Petrie, the Tiger pitcher. And rather than take him out of the fourth spot, I left him in the fourth spot. And in the seventh inning, he hit a grand slam home run, which basically won the ball game for us. So it's that kind of information that can help a manager make intelligent decisions.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you written some programs yourself or worked with some people now to automate a lot of these processes?
Well, now that I'm going on with San Diego, I'm going to encourage the Padres to use the computer to keep information basically on scouting reports of our minor league players and minor league prospects that we'll see with other ball clubs. On the big league level, I can see a big league manager not only keeping track of matchups of hitters versus pitchers, but where in the strike zone a hitter is liable to hit a home run or make an out, and where in the field he's liable to hit a ball so that you can station your defensive players a little more efficiently.
Now, did you use this computer during an actual game? Would you go to look for information as to what pinch hitter to pick, for example, what reliever to bring in?
I used to look at the matchups before the game, and then where there was a lot of information that was valid, I'd keep it on note cards that I had in my back pocket along with my lineup card. Actually, you can't use the computer and have a monitor in the dugout.
It's illegal?
Well, what they're afraid of is that you're stealing the signs from the catcher and getting an idea of what pitch is coming. So that's why baseball does not allow a TV monitor in the dugout.
Now, what does management and ownership think about your use of computers, you know, by managers and coaches?
They're a little bit resistant. The A's management is a little more progressive, and there are some young owners in baseball who are turning to the computer, Turner, Steinbrenner, the White Sox. But there are a lot of people in baseball who are very conservative and very resistant to any new idea like the computer.
Later in the segment, Chaffee and Kildall asked both Boros and Hicks about the hardware they used.
So this is all done in a larger computer system with a telephone connection. So
yeah, it's a mini computer. Quantel makes minis in three different sizes. Mm-hmm. and then the terminals are pulling off one terminal to 128 terminals.
And were you using a microcomputer, Steve, when you were with the A's?
We were using an Apple. And Jay Alves was assigned to putting that information in during the ball games and, of course, adding to it from our pitching charts once the games were over.
Boros's mention of the Apple II and Jay Alves are two key pieces of the story. But before delving more into them, let's discuss Boros's own background. Stephen Boros Jr. was born in 1936, the oldest of five children of parents who immigrated to the United States from Hungary. The family ran a small grocery store in Flint, Michigan. Boros played baseball from an early age, winning a state title playing shortstop for an American Legion team in 1952. In high school, he was a three-sport athlete and went on to play baseball for the University of Michigan. Boros did not enter college as a professional prospect, but he managed to play well in his first 2 years at Michigan and was named to the All-Big Ten Conference baseball team as a third baseman in 1957. That was when he received an unexpected offer to sign with the American League's Detroit Tigers. Major League Baseball did not have an amateur draft until 1965, so at this time, a college player could sign with any team they wanted. This often led to the wealthier Major League clubs signing as many prospects as possible to keep them locked in their minor league farm systems and away from the less wealthy teams. This system was great for the amateur players, as the bidding for their services drove up signing bonuses. So, of course, the Major League owners decided to try and crack down on their own lack of impulse control. In 1946, the owners adopted what became known as the bonus rule. Essentially, this rule stated that if you signed an amateur player for a bonus above a certain threshold, you had to either put the player on your major league roster by the end of that season or allow another team to claim them. In 1957, the bonus rule said that any amateur who received a bonus of at least $4,000 had to spend at least two full seasons on the 25-man major league roster. The Tigers offered Steve Boros a signing bonus of $25,000. It was an offer he just couldn't refuse. So Boros, all of 20 years old, made his Major League Baseball debut on June 19, 1957 at Yankee Stadium. The Yankees thrashed the Tigers that day 10-1. Boros entered the game as a pinch hitter during the top of the ninth inning and made the final out for Detroit. Boros played a total of 24 games that first season in Detroit. The following year, 1958, the baseball owners had eliminated the bonus rule. This meant that Boros was no longer guaranteed a second year on the major league roster, so he spent most of the 58 and 59 seasons playing for the Tigers' AA affiliate in Birmingham, Alabama. In 1960, Boros moved up to the AAA Denver Bears, where he had a breakout season, posting a .317 batting average, 30 home runs, and 119 RBIs. Fresh off that triumph, Boros rejoined the Tigers for what was considered his proper rookie season in 1961. Boros started the year strong, but was sidelined by a broken collarbone that kept him off the field for a month. In retrospect, that injury probably derailed his playing career. The following year, 1962, Boros only managed a .228 batting average. Detroit traded him in the offseason to the Chicago Cubs. He only made 41 appearances for Chicago before his contract was sold to the Cincinnati Reds' AAA affiliate in San Diego. Boros spent some time on the Reds' major league roster in 1964 and 1965, but after that his major league playing days were over. He spent another five seasons in AAA, including a stint in Vancouver, where he played with another future Oakland A's manager, Tony La Russa, before ending his playing career with the Kansas City Royals affiliate in Omaha, Nebraska. Boros began the transition to coaching in Omaha, where he was mentored by manager Jack McKeon. McKeon, who later led the Florida Marlins to the 2003 World Series title, brought Boros to the Florida Instructional League as a coach in 1969. The next year, Kansas City named Boros the manager of their single-A affiliate in Waterloo, Iowa, where he remained for the next three seasons. After stints managing in San Jose, California, and Puerto Rico, Boros returned to the major leagues in 1975 as the Royals' third base coach under manager Whitey Herzog. Boros spent four seasons with Herzog in Kansas City, during which time the Royals won three division titles. Boros later recalled that he would have been happy spending the rest of his career working for Herzog, but in 1979 the Royals dismissed Herzog and the rest of his staff, including Boros. Boros ended up taking a 40% pay cut to return to the minor leagues as manager of the Montreal Expos rookie team in Calgary, Alberta. After a year in Calgary, Boros joined the Expos as a coach for two seasons, spending the offseason managing for a second time in Puerto Rico. In 1983, he finally got the chance to manage his own major league club when he was hired by the Oakland Athletics. The legend of Steve Boros was that during his job interview with A's officials, he asked, "Will I have access to a computer?" as if this were his number one priority. This legend seems to have originated with a June 1983 Sports Illustrated profile by Ray Kennedy, who breathlessly described Boros as a manager, quote, "in the forefront of enlightened technocrats who are rewiring the game," unquote. Kennedy emphasized that Boros's embrace of computers put him in stark contrast to baseball's old guard managers, such as Billy Martin, the man that Boros replaced in Oakland. Martin told Kennedy that he didn't need a computer because, quote, "I've got it all up here," unquote, referring to his head. Now, Boros did apparently ask about computers during his job interview, but this was more a case of him doing research about a potential employer than him being some technocrat determined to put an Apple II in the dugout. In fact, the A's had embraced computers well before Boros was hired as part of their more modern approach to running a baseball team. At the time of this recording in June 2023, the Oakland A's are in the process of relocating to Las Vegas, Nevada. This would mark the latest in a series of moves for the storied franchise, which began as the Philadelphia Athletics in 1901. The A's relocated for the first time to Kansas City in 1954 under owner Arnold Johnson. 6 years after that, Johnson sold the team to Chicago businessman Charles Finley, who almost immediately went looking for a new city. He succeeded in 1968, relocating to Oakland. While the A's enjoyed great on-field success in Oakland, winning three consecutive World Series titles in the 1970s, Finley was still unhappy. As early as 1975, he went looking for yet another city. After failed attempts to move the A's to Seattle and then Denver, Finley opted to sell the team instead to San Francisco businessman Walter A. Haas Jr. in 1980 for $13 million. Haas was the chairman and former CEO of Levi Strauss & Company, the clothing manufacturer best known for their Levi's jeans. Haas named his son-in-law, attorney Roy Eisenhart, as the A's new president. Eisenhart, in turn, brought one of his former law partners, Sandy Alderson, to serve as the team's general counsel. And soon he was elevated to the role of general manager. Author Steve Kettman, writing in his 2015 biography of Sandy Alderson, said the Haas family had adopted a Silicon Valley approach to running their new baseball team. And what was more Silicon Valley than having computers? According to Kettman, it was a marketing consultant named Matt Levine who actually struck the deal that brought the Apple II Plus into the A's dugout, or at least into their press box. Eisenhart initially hired Levine to figure out ways to improve the A's lethargic attendance, which had dipped to less than 2,500 fans per game when the Haas family bought the team in August 1980. Eisenhart also wanted to improve the A's methods for analyzing player statistics. With those goals in mind, in late 1980, Levine met with Fred Hoare, then the vice president of communications at Apple Computer in nearby Cupertino, California. Levine offered Hoare a quid pro quo: free Apple II computers in exchange for free publicity from the A's. Levine told Hoare that the machines could be worth more than $1 million in public relations. Keep in mind, this was in late 1980. Apple had just started to enjoy sustained success with the Apple II following the release of the VisiCalc spreadsheet the previous year. The company was also about to go public that December and debut what it hoped would be its big breakthrough in the business microcomputer market, the Apple III. So any amount of free publicity, even from a struggling Major League Baseball team, probably sounded good to Hoare. Hoare gave Levine three Apple II Plus machines, but the Apple IIs were just one part of Levine's system. A 6502-based microcomputer running at 1 MHz with 48 kilobytes of memory didn't have the horsepower to do the sort of complex statistical analysis Levine envisioned. The Apples would therefore be used as data entry terminals connected by a 1200 baud modem to a PDP-10 mainframe at Digital Equipment Corporation in Philadelphia. Levine partnered with Richard Kramer, a Harvard and MIT-trained scientist, to develop the necessary statistical analysis software. The complete system was dubbed the Edge 1.000, or I'll just call it the Edge 1000 going forward. Levine hired Jay Alves, the person Steve Boros mentioned on air during his Chronicle appearance, to sit in the press box during games and enter data into the Apple II. Alves, a former college baseball player at the University of Arizona, had been working as a weekend television sports anchor before joining the A's as their new computer programmer. The decision to introduce computers did not sit well with Billy Martin, the man hired to manage the A's after the Haas family took over the team. Martin also initially served as the general manager before that role was given to Alderson, who had no prior baseball experience. At the time, Martin was between the second and third of what would ultimately be five stints managing the New York Yankees. Towards the end of the 1982 season, Martin's behavior had rankled Alderson to the point where the A's decided not to renew Martin's contract, so he went back to the Yankees. Alderson then decided to hire a manager who was temperamentally Martin's opposite in Steve Boros. Dating back to his playing days in the early 1960s, Boros gave off a more literary and educated vibe than the typical baseball player. And this played right into the hands of Sandy Alderson and Roy Eisenhardt, who were lawyers by trade and not baseball men. But there's no historical evidence to suggest that Boros was familiar with microcomputers, much less had used them in his prior coaching and minor league managing roles before arriving in Oakland. Ray Kennedy's Sports Illustrated profile suggested such a link, but there was no substantiation. And Boros made it clear to Kennedy that he wasn't in the dugout frantically leafing through pages of computer printouts during the game. Rather, he consulted the printouts of statistical analysis that Alves prepared before the game. Boros was also not the only manager touting computers in this time period. His former Vancouver teammate, Tony La Russa, was using the same Edge 1000 system while in his first stint managing the Chicago White Sox. Kennedy said two other managers, the Royals' Dick Houser and the San Francisco Giants' Frank Robinson, were also using some degree of computer-based analysis. Hank Harrison, writing in the debut issue of the Apple-focused magazine A+, said that he also spoke to another major league manager who worked with computers but wished to remain anonymous. This manager said that he used an Apple IIe with a Z80 card to maintain his own database of player statistics. The manager said he did this without the knowledge of his club, and that his son wrote the interface in the fourth programming language and connected it to a Pascal database. Harrison also talked to Boros and La Russa. Boros emphasized the use of computers in scouting new players. La Russa seemed more into the machine, however, explaining that he would set up a game before it was played and analyze a pitcher's likely choice of throws by placing any theoretical pitcher up against any theoretical batter. Boros was doing similar things, as he explained in the Duane Murphy anecdote that he told on Chronicles. Indeed, this particular anecdote was often cited in news coverage of Boros and his use of computers. As Boros told it, he decided to leave Duane Murphy in a game because of a particularly good pitching matchup, and Murphy went on to hit a grand slam. On the other hand, in a later game when Murphy got tagged out in a rundown between second and third bases, he told the press, perhaps jokingly, "The computer made me do it." Indeed, the computer generated a lot of attention for Boros, but it did not translate into on-field success. The Boros-led A's finished the 1983 season with a 74-88 record, fourth place in the American League West. Meanwhile, Tony La Russa's White Sox won the same division before falling to eventual World Series champion Baltimore in the American League Championship Series. The following year, 1984, the A's started 20-24 before general manager Sandy Alderson decided to fire Boros mid-season. Ultimately, it wasn't about the computers. It was that Alderson concluded he'd gone too far in replacing the emotionally explosive Billy Martin with the mild-mannered Steve Boros. Alderson recalled years later to Steve Kettman, quote, "Steve would never argue with an umpire. He refused. He said, 'Look, they're not going to change their mind, so I'm not going to argue with them. I kept saying, 'Look, Steve, this is part of the theater of the game and you have to do this,'" unquote. After leaving Oakland, Boros joined the San Diego Padres as coordinator of instruction for their minor league staff. This was the role he held when he appeared on Computer Chronicles. But it turned out that Boros would get one more shot at managing. At the start of spring training for the 1986 season, Padres manager Dick Williams abruptly resigned due to a power struggle with general manager Jack McKeon. You'll recall it was McKeon who gave Boros his first coaching opportunity in the major leagues back in 1969. And it was McKeon who decided to give Boros what would be his final managing job with the Padres. Boros only lasted the one season as manager, finishing with the same 74-88 record that he did in his only full year with Oakland. Boros briefly returned to the San Diego front office before moving to the Los Angeles Dodgers as a special assignment scout. It was with the Dodgers that Boros added an interesting footnote to that club's storied history. In preparing for the Dodgers' 1988 World Series matchup against Oakland, now managed by Tony La Russa, Boros and his fellow scouts noticed that A's relief pitcher Dennis Eckersley favored a backdoor slider when facing a left-handed batter with a full 3-2 pitch count. During Game 1 of the World Series, Dodger manager Tommy Lasorda used that piece of analysis and decided to bring in a left-handed batter, injured Dodgers outfielder Kirk Gibson to face Eckersley in the bottom of the ninth inning with the Dodgers down 5-4. As predicted, Eckersley threw a backdoor slider once the count hit 3-2. Gibson smashed the final pitch for a game-winning home run. The Dodgers went on to win the World Series in 5 games. Steve Boros remained with the Dodgers until 1993, eventually serving as the team's assistant minor league field coordinator. Boros never managed again, but he did reprise his role as the Kansas City Royals third base coach in 1993 and 1994 under manager Hal McCray. Boros then spent one more season as the Baltimore Orioles third base coach in 1995. In 1996, Boros returned to the team where his major league career began, the Detroit Tigers, where he served in a number of front office roles before retiring in 2004 as a special assistant to the general manager. Boros spent his final years living in Florida, where he died in 2010 due to cancer. As far as computers and baseball, that relationship only continued to grow as sabermetrics, the term coined by Bill James to describe empirical analysis of baseball statistics, became more popular, not just with the Oakland A's, but a number of other professional baseball clubs. Tony La Russa, one of the other early managers to embrace the use of computers, famously led the A's to a World Series title in 1989. Indeed, La Russa's success propelled him to endorse his own series of computer baseball games. It does make you wonder, though, if Steve Boros had led the A's to a pennant, would we have seen Steve Boros Championship Baseball for the Apple II? And that's all for this episode of the Chronicles Revisited podcast. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about the topics discussed in today's episode, there are links in the show notes. You can also visit my website, Computer Chronicles Revisited, at smoliva.blog. That's smoliva.blog. This episode was adapted from a blog post I published in November 2021, and it contains more on the people and products featured on the Computer Chronicles. In the next episode, I'll look at the story of Ashton Tate, the 1980s database giant that failed to move beyond its single product success. Talk to you then.